It's Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz.
If a woman's employer is a charity or a hospital that has a religious objection to providing contraceptive services as part of their health plan, the insurance company, not the hospital, not the charity, will be required to reach out and offer the woman contraceptive care free of charge.
President Obama on yesterday's compromise with religious institutions on providing reproductive services mandated by the health care law. James Fallows of The Atlantic joins us now, as he does most Saturdays, for a look behind the headlines. Jim, hello.
Hello, Guy.
Let's start with this episode. What was this, a blunder for the White House?
I think that's one of the fascinating questions about it, which leads to some larger fascinating questions about the Obama administration. Tactically, it appears to have been a blunder in that the administration, perhaps the president himself, did not foresee how much a resistance the initial ruling to mandate contraceptive coverage by a number of Catholic-affiliated institutions would cause even among some of his normal allies. But strategically, it may be that the president may have put himself in good political shape. Number one, he has resolved the issue early in the election year rather than letting it fester through the election year. Number two, he's positioned himself in the way that he is most comfortable being seen, as the man who weighs great conflicting issues and tries to find the reasonable compromise among people of goodwill. And number three, he has left a number of the Republicans in the position of being not just against abortion, which of course is a first-order moral issue, but being against contraception too, which is something where if they're seen as being anti-birth control, they're at odds with much of the American public.
Hmm. I want to ask you about some of these bigger issues. You have a monster cover story in the latest issue of The Atlantic. It's called Obama Explained. It wasn't like 12,000 words, right?
We think of it as a lean, mean, quick reading 12,000 words.
I got you. Okay. Well, you analyze the two competing views of the president. He's either a savvy chess player 10 steps ahead of the game or a naive, somewhat bumbling politician. What did you learn about the president that surprised you?
About him himself, I guess the two things that surprised me as I canvassed all sorts of people who had worked with him directly and were veterans of national politics going back many decades now is number one, how his personal distance, or what you might even call coldness, is a factor that many, many people who work in politics note and say is something that he needs to work around. The other thing that surprised me, too, is a sense that those around him are not the team of excellent rivals and superstars that one would have assumed he would have had around him. And that's something I hadn't expected to hear, but I heard many times.
What was your takeaway from the piece?
If there is a main lesson I tried to convey in this article, it is that every president fails, and every president starts out his first term not knowing many of the things that are most important about doing the job. And I ended up saying that in many ways we see evidence of President Obama learning the job in after some difficulties in the first year.
Jim, this past week a deal was reached with five of the biggest banks in the country to pay back some of the people who were wrongly foreclosed on. $26 billion deal. Is this the end? Is this justice served, in a sense, for predatory lending?
It's certainly not the end of the housing crisis because it won't really bring many of these homeowners out of their underwater situation. And it certainly is not justice done in any cosmic sense because in most cases, the fine for unjustly or in a rushed way foreclosing on people is $2,000, which obviously is not close to restitution. I think all we can see this is as a modest step towards trying to bring some clarity to the housing situation and at least something on the right side rather than the wrong side of the balance for institutional accountability.
That's James Fallows. He's national correspondent for The Atlantic. You can find his blog at jamesfallows.theatlantic.com. And his latest story, of course, is in the latest issue of The Atlantic. Jim, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Guy.
And speaking of the national mortgage settlement, the man who will dole out that money, all $26 billion, is a little-known banking official in North Carolina. His name is Joseph Smith Jr., and he'll oversee the five banks which agreed to new standards in servicing mortgage loans and dealing with foreclosure. Leonida Inge of North Carolina Public Radio has this profile.
Joseph Smith Jr. has spent nearly a decade as North Carolina's Commissioner of Banks. He is described as a man who understands the plight of the homeowner without forgetting what makes a successful bank industry work.
Joe is tough, he's thorough, and he's fair.
That's Roy Cooper, North Carolina's Attorney General. Cooper was a lead negotiator in the multi-billion-dollar mortgage settlement with Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Citigroup, and Ally Financial. Cooper recommended Smith for his new job. He says the agreement has big teeth and needs a tough watchdog, someone like Joseph Smith.
He has experience of knowing how banks operate. These issues are intricate and complicated, and it's important that we have someone who understands how things work. At the same time, as the North Carolina Commissioner of Banks, Joe Smith has a strong consumer protection record.
No one knows the exact details of Smith's new job. Since the mortgage crisis, he's spent much of his time defending consumers, like in 2009 before the House Financial Services Committee. Here he's introduced by Congressman Barney Frank.
There are people who consider you state regulators a nuisance, but we think you're an important part of the system. So we have Mr. Joseph Smith, who's the North Carolina Commissioner of Banks, and he's here on behalf of the Conference of State Bank Supervisors.
Yeah, chief nuisance, right.
Smith made it clear he didn't mind being a chief nuisance for the states and the consumer. While Commissioner of Banks in North Carolina, Smith supported the fight to end payday lending and helped set up one of the country's first foreclosure prevention counseling programs.
First of all, sir, if I might say so, we've just had a financial meltdown under subprime. The states were all over subprime for years. No one has ever said, to my knowledge, that the state regulation caused the subprime crisis. In fact, if anything, the state regulation was on top of the subprime crisis before anybody else.
Smith's office declined to make him available for an interview. Smith knows his way around the nation's capital and has worked in Washington before. And it's also not the first time the Obama administration has called him for help. About a year ago, President Obama nominated Smith to run the Federal Housing Finance Agency that regulates mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Smith withdrew his nomination after resistance from Senate Republicans. Now he's stepping forward again.
Would you want Joseph Smith's job?
No. I do not. No. This is going to be a brutal process.
John Connaughton is professor of financial economics at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte.
Whenever we have a settlement like this, okay, nobody ever gets what they want. It is always a series of compromises. And as a result of that, he's going to be dealing with parties on both sides of the issue who feel that they have been unfairly treated.
Smith isn't just a consumer advocate. He's also worked for a bank. But the West Virginia native won't return to D.C. to oversee the mortgage settlement. He'll set up an office in Raleigh with a team of auditors and attorneys to help with the process of divvying up the $25 billion. For NPR News, I'm Leonita Inge in Durham, North Carolina.
It's Weekends and All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Kwasi Kwarteng is in some ways a child of the British Empire. His parents were born in Ghana when it was subject to British rule. They eventually emigrated to London, where Kwasi was born. He eventually ended up at the finest boarding school, Eton College, and then to Cambridge, where he studied classics. Kwarteng worshipped Margaret Thatcher as a boy, and today he's one of just four Afro-British members of Parliament who's a conservative. Now, in another era, Kwasi Kwarteng may have been the ideal British civil servant sent to the colonies to administer the Queen's Empire. But Kwarteng is also an historian and one who's just written a scathing critique of that vast enterprise. It's called Ghosts of Empire, and in it, he focuses on six places the British administered, all places still coping with the aftermath of British rule.
If you look at Nigeria, where we've had flare-ups of religious conflict, we've had suicide bombings, we've had lots of people being killed.
This is Muslim-Christian.
That's a Muslim-Christian thing. But if you look at the actual geography, if you look at the map of Nigeria, you'll see that the Muslim area is in the north and the Christian area is predominantly in the south. This is reflects almost a tribal basis, if you like. And these problems essentially stem from the fact that the country is an artificial country. In fact, the term Nigeria appeared in a Times op-ed piece in 1897. So these artificial boundaries essentially set up a very tense situation in which different ethnic groups, different tribes were forced to come together where they had no real shared culture.
And we face those consequences to this day.
Absolutely.
You point to Kashmir, for example.
Well, Kashmir is a fascinating instance where the Hindu royal family was sold Kashmir in 1846.
Even though the majority of the population was Muslim.
Exactly, because this man, a man called Gulab Singh, had managed to ingratiate himself with the British. He'd managed to do well in the Sikh Empire, which controlled Kashmir previously. And the British didn't really want to rule Kashmir directly at that time. So they sold it to him. As a consequence of that, his family ruled Kashmir for 100 years. But when it came to independence, the Maharaja had the sole choice. And he decided, as a Hindu, to go with India. And, of course, that had massive consequences, which we still feel today.
I'm interested in your relationship with the story you write about because, of course, you are the child of immigrants, right? Your parents are from Ghana, and you, in some ways, are a product of some of these elite institutions that many
Absolutely.
Of these, right? You're an Oxbridge kid and
Harvard
Kennedy School, and now you're a member of parliament representing the Conservative Party, the party that many, I guess, would associate with tradition, these kinds of people that you write about. And I'm curious to get a sense of how you came to the Conservative Party.
I've really been drawn to the Conservative Party largely through Margaret Thatcher, the inspiration of Margaret Thatcher. And my conservatism is very much, if you like, an economic conservatism. I'm very much interested in free trade, in commerce, in wealth creation. In terms of empire, I think, if you look at the Conservatives' relationship to empire, yes, it is true. My family were probably victims, if you like, of a lot of the imperial tradition. But, you know, we've moved a long time, I think, from that time.
Did you grow up, I mean, did you, when you were growing up, did your folks talk about how their worldview and the world in which they inhabited was shaped for good or ill by empire?
Yes, I think they did. My parents were born in the early 40s, so that's a very important date because when Ghana, which was then called the Gold Coast, when it became independent in 1957, my parents were just finishing their high school. So that was a very formative age in which they were taught very largely by British teachers. And then as they left high school in the late 50s, the schools they attended became more Ghanaian in influence. So they were there right at the cusp. So obviously that shaped their views. And I heard a lot of stories about the old colonial times. I mean, my father remembers listening to the London Olympics in 1948 in his village on the radio. These kinds of memories were part of my experience growing up.
Those are complex memories, though, right? I mean, I've experienced this as well as an overseas correspondent where you meet people who remember empire and they remember things about it fondly, like your description of your father listening to the BBC. It's not just black and white.
Yeah. It's not exactly. I mean, this is what I'm trying to say is that, yes, there was a lot of exploitation. But in a country like the Gold Coast, people often forget that there were very few colonial administrators. The British were trying to run, certainly after the war, the empire on the cheap. The hand of government, if you like, was quite light. So if you went to Accra, which is the capital, you might see a few British officials. But in the villages and the countryside, they were much rarer. So people very much got on with their lives, almost as if the British weren't there in some parts of the empire. Now, that doesn't say that it was a kind of land of milk and honey and they did not feel that there was an alien force, if you like, in their country. But it does mean that some of the memories are quite fond.
I'm speaking with Kwasi Kwarteng. He's a conservative member of the British Parliament and the author of a new book called Ghosts of Empire. It's interesting because one of the main points you make is that democracy and the promotion of democracy cannot be exported. And you cite the example of Hong Kong, where you write about how this kind of parallel world of a British-style social hierarchy actually came about, not a liberal democracy. Can you describe
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely. Britain was in Hong Kong from 1841 to 1997. That's 156 years. During most of that time, the first 140 years, democracy was a sideshow. And in fact, one governor tried to bring in a little bit of democracy after the Second World War. That was completely overturned. That was not a path on which Hong Kong, as far as the British were concerned, should develop. And that's, I think, a very good example in which empire, while it could have imposed law and order, which it did in Hong Kong, was not about spreading democratic values. And in fact, I quote a civil servant in Burma. He said, "Forget all this rubbish about democracy. We're not trying to make the average Burman into a Brit. We're not trying to bring them political consciousness. We're simply trying to make sure they get a square meal and that there's some kind of law and order." And that was very much what I think the empire in reality was about.
What about, I guess you could call it the Monty Python argument, right? The famous scene where he says, "What have the Romans done for us, you know? Roads, bridges, wine, so on. I mean, that's an argument that people like Neil Ferguson and others who say, you know, there are things about empire that gave us the world we live in today, and we should be grateful for that. What about that argument about infrastructure, about roads, about order?
Obviously. I mean, that's one of the points I make. I mean, I say that there was a degree of order, and yes, there was quite a bit of infrastructure development. What I'm arguing against is this idea that you could export some sort of political idea of democracy.
It seems to me that when you were writing this book, you had another empire in mind, and that is the so-called American empire. I mean, do you think that in some ways the United States and the way it operates overseas has learned lessons from the UK or has in some ways ignored them?
I think a bit of both. I think actually, sure, when I started writing the book, I was very much living under the influence of current events. The Iraq War, which started in 2003, had happened. We're still living with the consequences of that. And the whole notion of neoconservative ideas of exporting American values, that was on the political agenda. And my book was very much, if you like, a response to that. And I think given the drift of American policy in the last 2 or 3 years, certainly with the election of Obama, I think the Americans are now much less inclined to try and export their values in that aggressive way.
That's Kwasi Kwarteng. He's a historian and a conservative member of the British Parliament. His new book is called Ghosts of Empire. It's out now. Kwasi Kwarteng, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
A couple of hours ago, we recorded history with an engineer named Casey Hopkins from Portland, Oregon. In 15 seconds, in 10 seconds, you will be a millionaire.
Well,
Casey and I were furiously refreshing a website called Kickstarter, where more than 12,000 people went to give him their money, $1.4 million of it. At 3 this afternoon, the funding became official. Here you go.
Boom.
The best things in life are free. You're good to go.
Pretty surreal.
Casey's the first person ever to collect $1 million from Kickstarter. It's a website that helps entrepreneurs fund their projects with help from donors. And for Casey, it all started when he got an idea to build a new, better iPhone dock, a little charger stand, because he didn't like any of the ones he found in the store.
They're these little plastic pucks, and they don't work if you have a case on your phone. And they're so lightweight that when you go to grab it, the whole thing comes with it.
So Casey designed his own, one made of solid aircraft aluminum, and it doesn't move around when you take your iPhone out of it. He calls it the Elevation Dock, and he put his appeal on the Kickstarter site back in December.
Then it just exploded across the internet. We hit that $75,000 goal in 8 hours. In 24 hours, we had $168,000 in pre-orders.
People want this thing. Casey's received orders from retailers all over the world, Taiwan, South Korea, Australia. He's also promised an elevation dock to every person who contributed $59 to the project. And everyone else, well, they can buy one for about $90, but they'll have to wait until later this year. Well, Casey, I'm going to let you go because you don't have a whole lot of time. You got to make 15,000 docks, man.
That's right. Nose to the grindstone.
That's Casey Hopkins. He's the founder of Elevation Lab and the creator of the Elevation Dock. His idea raised $1.5 million on Kickstarter. Casey, thanks so much.
Thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.